The tribe had found me then, and given me my true name. But Lak Wait was only a name after all. I had forged her myself, out of brokenness, learning to love wildness instead of fearing it, to thrive on the exhilaration of the hunt, charging headlong into the world, even, or especially, when it hurt to do it. Now I stood at the threshold of another great turning, perhaps the most important of my life. The sky had taken Dennis, but I knew there was life up there too. A combination of forces suited to me, to how I was made, in powerful ways. That great soaring freedom and unimaginable grace came fully tethered to risk and to fear. Flying demanded more courage and faith than I actually possessed, and it wanted my best, my whole self. I would have to work very hard to be any good at it at all, and be more than a little mad to be great, to give my life over to it. But that's just what I meant to do. The next morning, I was awake even before Tom was. I packed my few things quickly and waited for him in the dark. When he saw me, he smiled, understanding immediately the decision I'd come to, and what would happen now. When we returned to Nairobi, I clocked through hours of instruction like a possessed woman, taking every moment Tom could give me. 4 weeks after Dennis's accident, nearly to the day, Tom and I finished a short run and seamless landing at the aerodrome in Nairobi. Most of the town was yet asleep, and the Ngong Hills were draped over with mist and stillness. But the morning wasn't over. Tom had a secret in his pocket. Instead of taking her back to the hangar, where Ruta waited, he had me spin the moth around for another takeoff. This one would be mine, though. My first solo. "Just once around the paddock," he smiled. "Nice and steady." He took off his helmet and scrambled out casually, as if this were something we always did. Me alone behind the controls, and him on the ground. Nice and steady would certainly do it, but adrenaline tumbled through me so crazily, I felt dizzy. Could I remember everything Tom had said over the last months and put it to use? Could I quiet the clamoring in my head, the vision of the 10,000 things that could go wrong? Only one had taken Dennis's life, and that was still an utter mystery. Willing my hands still, I gave Tom a thumbs up. Ruta came out of the hangar and stood beside Tom, and I waved to them both, taxiing them off to the end of the Murrum Strip, where I pointed her nose at the implacable hills and opened the throttle. I thought about the tug of altitude and the moth's weight. I thought about speed and wind, the hundreds of adjustments Tom made without thinking, but that I was still learning. He had faith in me, though. I felt that solidly, and Ruta's belief in me, too, as he raised his hand once. Kwaheri. Farewell. Gunning hard, I sped along the hard-packed runway, my heart in my throat, every nerve alive. I waited until the last possible moment to pull back on the stick. And then the moth inched up, bobbling a little, and gradually steadied, finding the wind and her center. Behind me, I felt Tom and Ruta, and Dennis too. Before me lay everything. An entire world opening moment by moment under my own strong wings. I was off. Epilogue. 4 September, 1936. There is no way of knowing how close I have come to the clawing reach of the Atlantic when my engine finally kicks and thrashes to life again. The sound of it is jarring. It startles me as if I've been asleep for years and years. And it's possible I have been. I pushed the throttle forward to full power and eased back on the stick, away from the icy waves. The gull's nose tips upwards again, finally responsive. She climbs, scrabbling her way up, tooth and claw, scaling the face of the storm. I am climbing with her, out of an inner fog, a tangling blindness. It's only when I'm level again, and my hands have stopped trembling, that I let myself think about how long my engine might have been silent, and how ready I was to give in to the stall, to plummet when I felt the bottom go. I've always had that in me, but also a sound inner compass. There are things we find only at our lowest depths. The idea of wings, and then wings themselves. An ocean worth crossing one dark mile at a time. The whole of the sky. And whatever suffering has come is the necessary cost of such wonders, as Karen once said. The beautiful thrashing we do when we live. For several more hours, the black rain doesn't give way. I follow the rim of the long night, almost delirious with exhaustion, and also more awake than I have ever been. Finally, I spot the ghostly beginnings of daybreak. Or are those hints of land? The window glass has a mantle of ice, and fog shifts in front of my eyes. But soon I know I'm not imagining it. The grey-black canvas becomes water, and then clear waves, and then the growing form of a cliff's edge, like swept-up cloud ledges. I have reached North America, the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and Newfoundland. Flickering smudges becoming more real by the minute. This is the place I'm meant to go. My plan is to stop in Sydney, near Cape Breton, and refuel, then go on from there, straight south over land this time, New Brunswick and the tip of Maine, and finally to New York. But I am still 50 miles from land when my engine begins to sputter in a sick way, a hiccuping, lurching stall. My final fuel tank is 3/4 full, so it can only be an airlock. As before, I flip the toggle to the petcock, on and off, and the engine answers with wheezing. I'm dropping now, and my hopes are crashing too. 3,000 miles and darkness and near death to fail now, when I'm so close? It's a terrible thought, a dimming one. Again and again I flip the sharp petcock switch, my fingers bleeding. The gull coughs to life, climbing, only to falter once more, my propeller windmilling, my window glazed, glinting back the sun in a pitiless mirror. For 10 or 15 minutes I limp this way, in the wounded glide of fuel starvation, nearing the rough lip of landfall. Soon I can see muddy-looking boulders and a bog that's like black pudding. When I try to bank one final time, my wheels catch and sink, the nose sticking fast, throwing me forward. I smack the glass hard, wetting my forehead with blood. I am only 300 yards from the water's edge, nowhere near New York. And yet, I have done it. I am so tired and can barely move, but I do move. I push open the heavy door and force my feet to the ground. The bog tugs hard at my boots, and I sink, blood streaming into my eyes. I drop lower and am half crawling soon, as if after so many hours in the clouds, I have to remember all over again how to walk. As if I must relearn just where I am going and where, impossibly, I have been. Author's note. After her first solo, in June of 1931, Beryl Markham quickly went on to become one of the first women ever granted a professional B license. Though she never fully stopped training racehorses or winning derbies, she also became a bush pilot, working for Braw Blixen on numerous safaris, and pioneered the practice of scouting elephants from the air, fulfilling Dennis's vision. When, in 1936, after 21 hours of flying, she succeeded in her record-breaking voyage across the Atlantic, she made every significant headline in the States. A crowd of 5,000 cheered her arrival in New York, at Floyd Bennett Field. When she returned to England, however, she got no formal reception. Instead, she was greeted by the terrible news that her friend and flying mentor, Tom Campbell Black, had been killed in a plane crash while she was away. Scandal and speculation followed Beryl for much of her life. In 1942, she published a memoir, West with the Night. It sold only modestly, though many believed it deserved greater accolades, including Ernest Hemingway, who said in a letter to his editor, Maxwell Perkins, "Did you read Beryl Markham's book? She has written so well, and marvelously well, that I was simply ashamed of myself as a writer. It really is a bloody wonderful book." Hemingway met Beryl on safari in Kenya in 1934, when he was traveling with his second wife, Pauline Pfeiffer. Reportedly, Hemingway made a pass at Beryl and was rebuffed. Nearly 50 years later, his eldest son, Jack, showed some of his father's published letters to a friend, the restaurateur George Gutekunst, including the description of West with the Night. Gutekunst was driven to search out Markham's book, and then convinced a small California press to reissue it. It became a surprise bestseller and allowed Beryl, who was then 80 and living in poverty in Africa, to spend the remainder of her days in relative comfort and even some notoriety. Since then, the book's reputation, like its author's, has been marred by gossip and speculation. It's been suggested that she didn't write it at all, but instead that her third husband, Raoul Schumacher, a Hollywood ghostwriter, did. I can't say I'm surprised by the public's doubt in her. Beryl was so reluctant to talk about herself. Even people who believed they knew her quite well in later life were often surprised to learn she knew anything about flying or horse racing or could write more than a postcard. But the overwhelming evidence attests that Beryl had shown her publisher a large portion of the book, 18 chapters out of 24, before she ever met Raoul. Though they depict the same place and time, and house many of the same characters, Beryl's book hasn't found as wide an audience, or had the same impact as Isaac Dinesen's Out of Africa. But I believe it has the potential to. From the moment I read even a few sentences, West with the Night took powerful hold of my imagination. Beryl's descriptions of her African childhood, colonial Kenya in all its seasons, and her extraordinary adventures fairly leap off the page. But more striking to me is the spirit behind the words. She had so much nerve and pluck, plunging fearlessly into vast gaps between the sexes, and at a time when such feats were nearly unthinkable. I hadn't ever encountered anyone quite like her, a woman who lived by her own code instead of society's, though that cost her much. Who would have fit perfectly into Hemingway's muscular fiction, but she actually lived. Beryl was undoubtedly complicated. A riddle, a libertine, a maverick, a sphinx. But strangely, as I was writing her character and pitching myself deeply into her world, she became more knowable and familiar to me in some ways than Hadley Hemingway in my novel, The Paris Wife. Beryl and I share at least one profound piece of emotional genealogy. My mother also vanished from my life when I was 4 and returned when I was 20. I felt a bone-deep jolt when I discovered that link, and it became one reliable way to get close to Beryl and gain important insight into some of her more difficult choices. The loss of her son, for instance, is utterly heartbreaking to me. Though she would never be very close to Jarvis, who remained in England with Mansfield's mother, apparently he inherited Beryl's willfulness and her stoicism. He was proud of his mother's adventurous spirit and accomplishments, and felt more fondness for her than for his father, it appears, who was even more distant and unavailable. Beryl's relationship with Ruta spanned her lifetime, as their shared childhood experiences grew into mutual respect and unshakable trust. Though they were separated for a time in the 1930s, when she moved to England after the Second World War, she was able to track him down, and they were never again out of touch. Though Beryl kept her heart closed to most, and her secrets locked up tightly, her friends and confidants agree that, after Ruta and her father, Dennis Finch Hatton was very probably the only man she ever truly loved. She died in Nairobi in 1986, at the age of 83, near the 50th anniversary of her record-breaking flight, and perhaps thinking of the moment she climbed into her gull, tucking a hip flask of brandy into her flight jumpsuit. 22, she called out in Swahili as she buckled her helmet. I am going. Paula McLean, Cleveland, Ohio. This is Catherine McEwen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Circling the Sun by Paula McLean. This program was directed by Tony Huds. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2015 by Paula McLean. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.